Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking crisis-proofing your finances with Michelle Singletary.
Yeah, Joel, Michelle Singletary is an award-winning personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. She's also a frequent contributor to NPR, and she regularly appears on CNN and has also appeared on NBC's Today Show, on CBS's The Early Show as well. And Michelle, she's written multiple books on personal finance, and her latest book, What to Do with Your Money When Crisis Hits, was just published last month. Not only is it an incredible resource for folks who find themselves in difficult times right now, but it's also just chock full of practical money advice that we believe everyone should be incorporating into their lives. It's kind of the financial advice that your grandma would approve of, right? So we're excited to get to talk to Michelle Singletary today and learn more about her book. So Michelle, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Michelle, we are so glad to have you. You are a personal finance icon, I would say, at this point.
Oh, don't say that. That sounds so old.
No. It's just because you've been doing it so well for long enough.
Yes.
And you're not old. You got plenty of years left in here to like establish that personal finance icon status even more. But hey, Michelle, the first question we ask anyone who comes on the show, Matt and I, we like craft beer, something we're into, and we drink a craft beer on most episodes. But for us, it's something that we're willing to splurge on in the here and now while we're also trying to do a really good job of saving and investing for the future. So, yeah, do you have something like that, a splurge or craft beer equivalent?
Okay, so this is not going to go over well, but my hobby is saving money. So if you ask like my husband or my kids what I splurge on, they would just roll their eyes. So, I think probably multiple Scrabble dictionaries
okay.
would probably be the only thing. I just don't have a lot of things that I really want, to be honest. I know it's terrible, but
no.
I think
multiple Scrabble dictionaries, to me that sounds extravagant. I would never buy that. So
I have a mini one and a big one, but I just don't, it's so interesting you ask that, because when it comes time for holidays or Christmas or my birthday or anniversary, my kids and my husband are like, well, what do you want? And I just can't think of anything, because I just am so comfortable in my skin, and I'm comfortable with the things that I do for people as enjoyment. Mm. And I know I don't want it to sound so pious, but when you don't come from a lot and you just spend your whole life trying to create financial security, when you get secure, that's sort of the gift itself.
Mm.
And I just, yep. I don't want any jewelry or clothes or a certain kind of car or even craft beer. I don't really drink, but if I did, it would be craft beer. I just don't want for anything.
That's awesome. I think that says a lot about who you are as a person. And I mean, and I picked up on something there too. You mentioned how just your ability to help others. And I think oftentimes when you are comfortable, when you are in a position of just where your finances are solid like that, oftentimes you can look to other people and find ways to enrich their lives. That's certainly something that you've done over the years. You've been writing just great money content now for the Washington Post for years. Can you tell us some of like the early Michelle Singletary story? what got you interested in money in the first place? And then, what spurred you on to actually write about it?
Yeah. So I was, I came to live with my grandmother, who we call Big Mama, when I was four. And there were five of us who ended up, she took in. So my older sister, who was eight, I was four, as I said. I had a sister who was three, and twin brothers who were just under two. And so we came to live with my grandmother. My grandfather, although a good guy, just had, he had a drinking problem. So he didn't always come home. He didn't always come home with his money. And so my grandmother had to make do caring for us with the money that she earned as a nursing assistant in a hospital. And my grandmother also didn't take the welfare cash payments because she was just so proud and she didn't want them in the house and telling her what she could and couldn't have. And so just on her salary, she raised us. And I learned at her feet. I mean, my grandmother, if she held a penny, Lincoln would scream. That's how tight she was. And the thing that I learned from her is that she never apologized for what she couldn't buy us. You know, sometimes when you grow up poor and your parents can't give you, they just feel always so sorry about that. And you pick up on that as a child. She never felt sorry that she couldn't buy us brand name sneakers or we didn't have a lot of clothes and things like that. Because she just said, listen, this is all I can afford. And you need to be satisfied with that. And I need to be satisfied with that. And that's what I picked up from my grandmother. So now fast forward, I'm working for the Baltimore Evening Sun, covering, you know, cops and county government. And the business editor, who's a female, a woman came up to me. It was Patricia Fanning. She said, you know, listen, I'm trying to rebuild the business section and I want young people. I want blacks. I want women. You know, she just wanted to create a diverse staff because back in the day, the business section was all about, you know, just business and investing. And it was, let's just be clear, it was just white guys, right? Older white guys. And oftentimes it was people sort of towards the end of their career. It was a comfortable place. You didn't have to work weekends. You didn't have to work holidays. And so it was kind of the place you went. You did good work, but you were kind of on your way out to retire. And when she asked me, I thought, oh, are y'all trying to tell me something? And she said, no, no, dear. And so I went to work for the business section. And then because of my work for the Evening Sun, I got noticed by the Post. They offered me a position. I took it. And as I'm very Baltimorean, so very down to earth. And I go to Washington Newsroom where people are having these power lunches. And I'm bringing my bag lunch to work, yes, eating at my desk. And people are like, you want to go out to lunch? I was like, you people are insane. Yeah. All this money that y'all spending or eating and things. And I would just talk a lot about saving and the things that my grandmother taught me. And these people are looking at me like, where did they get this country bumpkin? And then my business editor said, you know, you tell all these stories about your grandmother and how you were raised and money issues. You ought to just write a column about that. We've never had anything like that in the business section. Just a personal finance column about what it's been like to be raised, you know, as an African-American in Baltimore inner city. And I wrote that first column. It was called Big Mama's Savings Grace. I'll never forget. And at that time, you know, we weren't into like instant messaging and email. So people were actually sent letters. They got so many bags of letters that it was just unheard of that somebody in the business section was getting all these letters from all across the country. People had picked up the column from different sites. And they were just like, oh my gosh, you're writing for me. And they understood that I was a black female, but they were like, yeah, I had a grandmother like that and she was Jewish, mm-hmm, or I had, you know, a pop like that. And it just, that's sort of how I got into this space of personal finance, just by living among my peers, the things that my grandmother taught me about money.
Wow. Your grandma sounds like such an incredible woman. And yeah, can you share maybe like some of the, I love what you mentioned when you're talking about like to not be ashamed of the fact that you can't spend money on certain things. What else did she teach you that you still live by today or that are still just incredibly important principles for you?
Well, so much. It's just like, well, the one thing she taught me that I have lived by. So my grandmother taught me that the moment you get your first paycheck, don't care what it's doing, if you get it in cash or a paycheck, you put aside a certain percentage of that check or that, you know, deposit every single time you get a check. And I started working when I was about 14. I was a mentor, tutor to some other children. And so from that very first check, she taught me how to put some money aside, whether it be 10% or 20%. She's like, even if it's just a dollar, every piece of money that crosses your palm, you shave off a piece for saving. And so when I graduated from University of Maryland College Park and I went to work full time for the Evening Sun, my first day I covered this huge fire in downtown Baltimore. And it was just like, you know, I was really in the midst of it. And my story made the front page, of course. And I called my grandmother and I said, "Oh, my mama, I'm on the front page of the Evening Sun." She says to me, "Did you go up to HR and make sure that you took part of your paycheck and put it in the credit union?" I said, "No, did I tell you I was covered?" Click up. And I said, "Did this woman hang up on me?" I thought, okay, it was must have been an accident. So I called her right back. I said, "Oh, the phone must got disconnected." And I started to tell her about my big story. And she says, "Did you go make sure that a part of your paycheck is put away in the bank?" I said, "No, I had time to do that." Click up. I said, I'm a guard dog. And so I left my desk at that moment, that my big day, and I went up to HR and I made sure that a portion of my paycheck was put away. Then I went back to the newsroom and I called her. She asked the same question. I said, "I sure did." Now she said, "Now tell me about that story."
That's awesome.
Wow.
And I've lived by that. Everything I get, if it's a book advance, it's whatever, I put money aside right away. Always. I don't splurge at all. And that was the key part of what she taught me. And then I think secondarily, my grandmother just always talked about not giving into peer pressure. As a child, as a teenager, as a young adult, as a, you know, working professional, you just do what you can afford and don't worry about what anybody else says. And I just live my life like that. You know, I work at the Washington Post. I've been on, you know, big news programs. I've been, you know, when Oprah had her television show. And I remember when I was going to be on the Oprah show, my nephew was like, "Oh, you're big time now." And that time I was driving some used car. He said, "You need to get a new car because this is your life now." And I was just like, "Nope, just driving this old car." In fact, I didn't even get my hair done for Oprah show. I wore the same outfit I had in one of my in my closet because I said Oprah hasn't seen anything that I've worn before. I did not make a big deal about it at all. And that's something that I learned from my grandmother.
That's awesome. I mean, so yeah, you mentioned peer pressure, even from your nephew. You know, he's trying to pressure you into getting a nicer car.
Exactly.
You've been in the space for a while now. Like, what are some of the different changes you've seen over the years, either in the personal finance space or, you know, even just in our culture today, you know, that you feel has made it harder to convince others to make smart moves with their money, right? Like, obviously, peer pressure has been around for forever. Yeah. But do you feel like that you've seen certain aspects of our life just kind of ramp up in the recent years?
I think with the advent of social media, you can see more of what people are doing 24/7. So, you know, we always had the television shows, the rich and famous shows and things like that, that kind of pressure in commercials. But now we have it not just on our television, but now we have it every time we look at our phone, you know, every time we sign on to work, you know, you have ads following you across platforms. And so there's more of a barrage of what you have isn't good enough, that you need to update. Like, look at this cool thing. Look at these cool people. You have influencers who are paid to wear certain things and do certain things that make you feel like you're missing out. Even with Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, one thing that struck me with my children, because obviously my husband and I have raised them similarly to how we were raised and how my grandmother raised me. My children, first of all, we forbid them to have social media when they were young, but they decided on their own when they got older and they could get it, that they wouldn't do it. And my oldest said to me, "Mom, I really don't want to be on Facebook because all people ever do is post about stuff they're doing, like they're bragging." And that just always made me feel bad that I couldn't do something that they were doing. And I didn't want want that coming into my spirit. And so my children on their own decided that they didn't want to be on those platforms constantly being sort of one-upped by friends and all the things that they do, because that's really what most people are really doing. They're kind of just bragging, look at my life, look at where I'm going. And I think that has put extra pressure on folks to do some things with their money and their life that they're not ready for. You know, I'm a big component of home ownership, but because of all these things that you see, you should have a home, you should have a home. And people jump out there sooner than they're ready, or they have to take vacations when they really need to be paying off their credit card debt. And I don't necessarily blame them, because there is a masterful machine out there to get you to feel unsatisfied with what you have.
I think you're spot on. I think we all feel that to a certain degree. And I think social media is one of the biggest culprits. And the internet certainly can help us feel connected in some ways, but there are a lot of downsides to our constant connectedness too. Michelle, before we dive into talking more about your new book, What to Do with Your Money When Crisis Hits, let's touch on another crisis that some people find themselves in. I was just like really kind of struck by reading about your work helping inmates. That's just like really important work, because I would imagine life is just so difficult for men and women once they get released from jail. So like what's your work look like when, in that capacity?
Yeah, so I have a financial ministry at my church, and we meet once a month for a couple of hours, actually about 3 hours to be honest, where I teach classes about personal finance. And as part of that, my church requires every ministry to have an outreach. I would have done it anyway, but we chose to do prison outreach. So my husband and I pre-pandemic, we would go to correctional institutions and teach our classes in a reentry program. So programs that are set up to help people who are about to be released from prison, how to, you know, handle work, how to handle, you know, personal crises that have happened. And then we do the financial component. So we teach a series of classes to them, to both men and women, about how do you get rid of a sense of entitlement? How do you make better financial decisions? We teach class on credit, how to rebuild your credit. We teach a class on love and money. Like, you've been in prison for 10 years and you had kids before going in, and there's a lot of pressure for once you get out to make up for that time by buying people stuff and doing things that they can't afford just yet. And so it's such a rewarding work. I can't even express how wonderful it is to go into the institutions. And I know people are thinking, but didn't they do a lot of bad stuff? Yeah, they did. And they're paying the price for that, and they're going to come out. And we want to make sure that when they come out, they are as whole as possible. Yeah. Because if we don't have programs like this, if we don't allow them to take classes and have some things inside the institutions, then how are they going to rejoin society in a way that will be a contributor to us? Otherwise, they're going to go back to doing the things that they did to get in prison in the first place. And so this is a throwaway population. People don't want to help them. They don't think that they deserve help, but they are going to get out, and we have to help them, because they are, when we help them, we help ourselves. And so when people criticize, you know, programs for prisoners, or, you know, people who are formerly incarcerated, they're not sort of thinking, well, okay, altruistically, but how about we just think, if we don't help them, they're going to be criminals again, and that doesn't help you. But I want to help them, because if you hear a lot of their backstories, right, they come from broken homes, they come from homes where they were abused, and, you know, single family homes where there wasn't enough money. And so those who are in there for drug selling often resorted to that to put food on the table for their siblings. That doesn't excuse their behavior, but it does explain it. And when you listen to them and you work with them, it's very rewarding to know that you can change somebody's life and the trajectory. And when you help them, you help their family and their children, and you can break the legacy that has been created in a lot of their families. And so it is one of the proudest things that I do, that I feel like it's really good work. And when maybe we can't help 100% of them, but even if we just help 10%, that's a huge difference. Yeah. These are people too, who made really bad choices, but we still have to help them.
Well, Michelle, we're glad to hear that you're doing that. You're obviously providing hope for those, you know, those inmates who you're working with. And, you know, you've also provided a lot of hope for folks with your new book, What to Do with Your Money When Crisis Hits. And we're actually going to dive into that. We're going to talk about that right after this break.
All right, we're back from the break. We're talking with Michelle Singletary, one of the greatest personal finance writers of all time. She'd definitely be on the Mount Rushmore of personal finance writers, I think. And Michelle, you just recently published your new book, What to Do with Your Money When Crisis Hits. Obviously, COVID produced a health crisis that led to an economic and then a personal finance crisis for so many folks. Like, was that the primary motivation behind writing this book?
It was. So I wrote the book with the idea that I didn't want to just discuss the current crisis, the pandemic. It's horrible. It just caused such economic dismay for so many people. You know, millions of people lost their jobs, in addition to dealing with health issues, and that there's a cost to that. But I wanted to just remind people that this crisis will pass and there'll be another one. And I just need you to be prepared for that next one, but not out of fear. Right? Because I was thinking about, how do I explain this book so that people don't get scared? Because you use the word crisis and already your, you know, anxiety levels go up, right?
Yep.
But I thought about it in a sense of the people who work in fire stations, the men and women who fight fires. They have all their equipment ready at a moment's notice, right? The hoses, the trucks, everything is positioned for when they get that call for the fire. So they can be in that truck and on the street at a moment's notice. Mm-hmm. They hope that there will never be another fire. It would not be prudent for them not to prepare for that next fire. That's what this book is, right? You don't want it to happen. You just really hope it doesn't. But you know that it's going to be another financial fire. Maybe you'll get a little scorched, or maybe things will burn down in terms of you've lost your job. But you got to position yourself. And just like those firefighters, sometimes they can tame that fire, and sometimes it's too overwhelming. And that is exactly what happens in people's lives. But it doesn't matter, because they're still prepared no matter what. And that's what this book is. It helps you to prepare, not out of fear, but that you need to plan. So that means that as you're going through this crisis, and that's the first part of the book, it's like, okay, I don't have a job. What do I have to pay? And then as part of the book, it's like, okay, I've come through this crisis. What do I need to do to make up for mistakes that I made before that last crisis? Can I do some things to put myself in a better position? And there are some things that you can do. And even if you save like a crazy person, which is what I do, you still might not have enough, but you'll still be able to weather that storm a little bit longer.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the focus of this book.
That's right. Yeah. Well, let's kind of talk about some of that crisis section, Michelle, that you've got in your book. You know, it can be hard, I think, for folks to know which obligations to prioritize when they're in that state of dire need, right? And so you actually have sort of a triage list that you run through in the book. And so let's talk about that. Which bills are important, and then which ones do you think should fall by the wayside when those hard times hit?
Yeah. I'd like to start by even just explaining what triage means.
Oh, yeah.
Not
sure.
Assuming that everybody knows that. And so I got the idea from when you visit an emergency room, right? And let's say you broke your ankle and you're there and you're waiting and you're like, oh my gosh, when are they going to ever see me? And then someone comes in and they take them right back. And you're just like, wait a minute, I was here. What is wrong with you all? But you don't know that person's having a heart attack.
Yeah.
And so when you have a crowded emergency room or not a lot of staff, they have to triage the patients. Who are the most critical? Let's handle them them first doesn't mean that you are not important or that we shouldn't get to you, but we can't get to you right now. And that's how you have to think of your bills when you've had a disruption in your income or you've been laid off or furloughed. And so you have to look at the things that are the most necessary for you. Food on the table, roof over your head, covering the utilities, you know, paying that car note if you need that car to go look for a job. And other bills need to just be forgotten for right now. Now, I say that saying, I'm not saying that those bills should not be paid. But the reality is, if you've lost your job and you only have $200, I don't need you to pay that credit card bill. I need you to put food on your table. And you have to be okay with that. Because what happens often is, and we drill it, you guys do it, I do it. We drill into everybody's head, pay your bills on time. Do whatever you can. Cut costs. You know, cover that stuff. Get going. And so that when a crisis happens, people try to pay a little bit on everything because they don't want to be that person that's reckless. But this is not being reckless. This is being a realist, right? You only have so much money. And so you have to triage your bills. And you can't let those less critical bills make you put them ahead of other things. So if you've got a limited amount, talk to your landlord, pay what you can, but you gotta feed your kids tonight. And that's what you focus on. And later, when you get employed again and back on your feet, I can help you build your credit back up. I can tell you how to do that. It doesn't take as long as you think it does. Let's just focus on the emergency stuff right now.
Yeah, one of the things you talk really well about in your book too is what it looks like to turn to friends or family for money. That can get really, really tricky. So, like, let's say you are in a hard financial spot. Like, how do you navigate asking other people to help you out?
You just have to ask them. You know, oftentimes the first thing you want to do is like, can you give me a loan? Because you feel like people will be more receptive to that, the idea that you're going to give them their money back. But if you've lost your job and you've had some disruption in your income and you've just fallen financially, you don't really know when you can pay that loan back. And making promises that you can't keep is what ruins that relationship. Mm-hmm. So I'd rather you say, listen, you know, I lost my job. We had this huge pandemic. I don't know when I could pay you back. So rather than ask for a loan and set up a situation where you're going to be expecting something back that I'm not sure when I could pay, if you can afford it, can you give me a financial gift to help me out right now? Could you pay my utility bill for a month or two for me if that's possible? I need help with my rent this month. If you cover it this month, I think I can get enough to pay it next month. My kids need some things for the summer, for summer camp. Do you think you could help me pay for summer camp? And these are hard conversations because we are very proud people and you don't want to ask that way. But I think that's the best way. And if you're on the receiving end of that, because many of your listeners will be on the receiving end, I need you to open up your wallet if you can afford it. I need you to give out of your extra. So don't give somebody your rent money. But I need you to hear them. And if they, even if they ask for a loan, you say, no way, I'm giving you this money. My husband and I don't lend money to anyone. So, and we also look around for people who need help, even though they are too proud to ask. This happened to us. A relative lost her job in the food service industry, and she was talking to another relative. She would never tell us. And so we heard the story, and I called her up, and I asked her how much her rent was, and I called her rental office, and we arranged to pay her rent for a couple of months. And she said, oh, thank you. She's so grateful. She's like, I'm going to pay you back. And I stopped her right there. I said, absolutely not. You will not pay us back. This is a gift. And you do not ever have to think about it again. We don't bring it up to her. We don't mention it. Nothing. This was something we did for her. And never will we expect it back. And you know those people in your lives who could need help. Maybe it was maybe your favorite restaurant that you go to and you know the staff is only working half time. And there's a waitress or there's somebody who you talk to all the time. You know, just, hey, how you doing? How's it going? Are you getting the hours? And they go, no, well, you know. And then when you leave that tip, you leave enough that you know can help pay their rent for the month. Right?
Yeah, that's ridiculously cool. And I mean, yeah, just I love your attitude towards that too, because it puts somebody in a position where yeah, they're far more comfortable taking that money, and it's and you're saving that relationship. When so, whereas that obligation can cause someone to avoid maybe interacting with you, like
exactly.
if you owe the loan, they're you've put them at ease, which is really cool.
Right.
Yeah, and Michelle, another situation too. If someone has lost their job, they might be tempted to draw on some, like, say, some retirement funds.
Right.
And so we would love to hear your thoughts, you know, on taking money, say, out of a 401k, taking some money out of a Roth IRA for some of those difficult financial times.
Yeah, it should be the last resort, but it is a pot that you might have to tap. And I think it would be arrogant for those of us who didn't lose their jobs, who have adequate savings, to say, absolutely don't ever touch that money.
Mm-hmm,
well, the reality is, it's either touch that money or you can't pay your rent. It's either touch that money or you can't put food on the table. I'm okay with you touching that money. It's not ideal. But if you have to, and then if you do, don't take out more than you need. So you can take it out over time as the need arises. So if you've been laid off and you're not sure, you know, take out enough for like maybe 2 months, but not like 6 months. And if obviously if you're under 59 and a half, when you take out the money, this is going to be so hard for people. At least please make sure you put aside the tax obligation for that money. So if you're under 59 and a half, there's a 10% early penalty. And then obviously you have to pay income tax on that money. So you want to get some advice from the plan administrator, and they can give you some guidelines about how much you probably need to set aside. And then you really, really need to set that money aside. I don't want you to be in trouble with the IRS when it comes time to pay that money back.
Yeah, that would be a really, really bad situation. Like you're putting yourself in another crisis then,
that's
essentially,
right.
when that hits.
That's right.
And Michelle, in your book, there's so much good, just like regular personal finance information too. And we want to get to kind of some questions that we have for you on that, including like one thing about discounts making us dumb. Those are my favorite lines from the book. We'll talk about that right after this break.
We are back and we're talking with Michelle Singletary. We're talking about crisis-proofing your finances. And Michelle, you know, managing our money well, that's one of the steps that we can take to avoid getting into a financial crisis to begin with, right? And budgets, they're an important tool. And you say in your book that if you like being broke, then don't budget. So it's just really important. Something that stood out to us, though, you don't give a whole lot of credence to the different budgeting apps, you know, like going with the latest new software or this new program. Why is that? Can you explain that some to our listeners?
You know, people are always asking me, okay, so what app should I use to manage my money? And I just go, I don't know, pens on paper. That's what I use. And I get it. People want that cool tool. And they are cool, right? I have a couple that I just use out of fun. But here's the thing. This is what I tell people all the time. It is not that app that is going to make you manage your money better. By the time people want to use an app, they have become motivated to get their financial life together. And this is an example that I use. Like, and I know a lot of people out there are going to be in this position. So you buy that treadmill or the exercise bike because you're going to ride it every day.
Hopefully and you didn't drop $5,000 on it.
Exactly, right. And what does it end up happening to be? A clothes hanger, right? And so that treadmill and that bike can absolutely help you get in shape. But if you don't have the motivation to use it, it's nothing but a clothes hanger.
Yeah.
And that's what the budget apps are, right? And so you need to first, most importantly, say, I want to have control over my money. And then once you say that, it doesn't matter what app you use. I'm sitting talking to you right now, and in front of me is a little red notebook that I got at the dollar store. And I write down my financial stuff and things, the financial stuff I have to do. Like right now, I've got to move some money into a fund in my SEP account. And I wrote down, okay, call the company. And I'm not using no apps. I'm not on no Excel. I'm not on anything. I'm not saying I don't use those tools, nor should you if you find one that you like. But that is not what makes you a good money manager. It starts with your mind and your mindset. That is the tool that will help bring you prosperity. Those other things are a bonus. They're helpful. And so I don't really care what you use, right? Because you see all these ads, and this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. It is for the people who are already motivated. But the people I work with, you're not, let me put it this way, you're not broke because you don't use a cool app.
Yeah.
Yep. You're broke because you're not budgeting in general. That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And, all right. So let's get to one of my favorite lines in the whole book. It just stuck out to me. You said, discounts make us dumb. What do you mean by that? Because I like a deal from time to time, Michelle. I'm not going to lie.
I'm not saying that I don't. I use coupons too. But one of my favorite books is called Dollars and Cents. I love this book, and I actually reference it to it in my book. And it talks about behavioral economics and how we are so concentrated on a discount that we don't realize that they make us dumb, that they use the lure of a discount to get you to spend and spend more than you intend to spend. Let me give an example. So you go into a store, you're only going to go get one pair of shoes. Your kid needs a pair of sneakers. They only need one pair of sneakers. They only got one pair of feet. And you go to the store and it says, well, if you buy this pair, you can get this pair for half off. And you're thinking, that's a deal. But is it? You only went in there to get one pair of shoes. Now you have spent, even at what might be considered 50% off, more money than you intended to go into that store. And that makes you, I hate to say it, dumb, right? Because they are using you. And you know darn well that they have priced both those shoes to account for that discount. You know, and then we concentrate on that so much that we, you know, the reward cards, credit card reward cards, they're so proud of all those award points that they've accumulated. Now, how exactly did you accumulate those award points? You
spent on
a credit card, right? You've got to spend a certain amount of money, right? And studies show that when you use plastic, you tend to spend more than you use cash. So they've built all of that into all of these things that you're thinking you're getting a discount on. And so it doesn't mean that you shouldn't take advantage of discounts, but just understand that there is a method to their madness to get you to overspend.
That's right. Yeah, they're playing chess while you're playing checkers.
Right? That's exactly
looking at that deal, but they've already they're two moves ahead of you.
They are two and three moves ahead of you, right? I mean, even grocery store coupons, people clipping and and you're buying all this stuff, and you know, any of those coupons, if you know you'll have to buy more to get that 50 cents off, or they have 10 for $1 or 10 for $10, but you only need one can. So in your head, you're thinking, I got to buy those 10 to get that discount, but you don't, right?
That's right.
And sometimes I even have to stop myself. It's like, oh, 3 cans for X. And I said, well, I'm making a stew, for example, but I really don't need those extra 2 cans right now. And if you really look, it says, and then they do divide it up by that 3. So you're not overpaying if you buy just the 1. And so you just have to continually talk yourself to, do I really need this? Even if it's less money, I'm still spending money on something that I never intended to spend it on.
Mm, that's right. Yeah. So, Michelle, let's talk about our relationship too with debt. Mm. You wrote an article at one point that was titled, "If You're in Debt, You Don't Deserve a Vacation." And readers didn't really like that one.
Yeah, I'm sure you got some pushback on that one.
About your thoughts on debts, you know, as well as treating yourself when you've still got some debt lingering in your life.
Yeah, that I knew I was being provocative. I did not know that they were going to put a hit out on me.
Yeah, how dare you?
Oh my goodness, you would have thought I slapped somebody's baby. And I was trying to be provocative. I'm not going to lie, I was. Because what happens is I hear people say all the time, well, I deserve this and I work hard and I deserve this. And I'm sure you do work hard, but you don't deserve to be in debt. And you don't deserve that vacation that you can't afford when you've got credit card debt that you need to pay off. Or people will say, I save for my wedding, but you have $10,000 in credit card debt. So that doesn't sort of mesh with me. And so I like to joke that if debt was a person, I'd slap it. I hate debt. I hate that it limits your choices. And so what I was trying to tell people is that you can have a vacation without spending money that you don't have that you need to put towards reducing your debt. And this goes back to, you know, when we talked about the things that my grandmother taught me about being satisfied where I am. And so we have in this country told people that a proper vacation is that you got to go somewhere, you got to spend money, you got to do this. When in fact, a vacation really ought to be, I just need time away from work. I need to just be peaceful. I could walk through my neighborhood. I could sit on my porch. I could, you know, call friends. I could spend time playing games with my family. The most important thing you need to do is to get your finances together so that when the next crisis hits, you can weather that storm. And so if you have a lot of credit card debt, I'd rather you spend that time taking that money that you would have used on a paid vacation and bring that debt down. And I know that might mean that you don't take a vacation for a couple of years, but it's only for a season. And that during that time that you get rid of that debt, by the time you do have the money, the cash, the freedom to take that vacation, it will be a sweet time because you don't come back to that debt.
How much nicer to take that vacation knowing that you actually have the money in the bank to pay for it, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
And at what point in the book, Michelle, you say debt is debt, and you don't distinguish really between good debt and bad debt. So I find that interesting because there's definitely, you know, some people, especially Matt and I as real estate investors, we have a slightly different take on debt. We're mom and pop real estate investors, not these like big time guys with hundreds of units or anything like that. But debt is different in the real estate space, I think, at times. So yeah, what's your take on debt? When you say debt is debt, do you distinguish in any way between certain kinds of debt that maybe make sense for individuals at a certain point in their life or not at all?
You know, I love you guys, right? It's like, you're talking about my books. I shouldn't talk about you.
Hey, you're welcome. You're welcome to throw us under the bus, too, if you want.
So here's my strategy about talking about debt. First of all, there is no such thing as good debt and bad debt because we're ascribing adjectives to something that nobody likes. I mean, you use debt to get some things that you want, like a home, but you don't like it. You don't feel good about it. You know, when you write that check, you are not skipping through to the mailbox going, I love that I have to pay this interest on this money. Isn't this glorious? No. You know, and on the other side, you know, bad debt, what is that? It's still just debt. And what I try to get people to think about it in a sense of debt limits your choices, particularly during a crisis. Let's just look at the pandemic and landlords, for example. And so I tell you, I talked to a landlord from North Carolina, sweet guy. I did a column on it. And he has multiple properties, you know, small, you know, not some big conglomerate. But he said that I told myself that I wanted property and that I was going to make extra payments so that I could pay the properties off as quick as possible so that in the times of trouble, I don't have to press my tenants because they're all good people. He chooses his tenants wisely. And he said, when they are at their lowest, I don't want to be that landlord that says, give me my money or get out. And he was able to give his tenants breathing room at the height of the pandemic because he didn't have loans on those properties. And lots of landlords have properties that they need every dollar of that rent or they're going to go under pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And that's not a wise use of debt. So I just try to get people to get out of debt so that when that next crisis happens, and it will, you as a landlord can be more magnanimous to your tenants because you don't have to worry about the mortgage you have to pay. Now, that's not to say that you may not be there yet, but I hope that you strive to be there.
Yeah.
So that you don't have all that financial pressure. You have breathing room so that you can be humane during a time that was inhumane.
Man, Michelle, your generosity of spirit, it just comes through in this conversation. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you. So much wisdom and just so much humor. So thank you so much for joining us. Like, where can our listeners find out more about you and your new book?
Well, first of all, I'd love you to follow me on Twitter. It's at SingletaryM. That's the platform I like the most. Sign up for the Washington Post and get my columns and newsletter. I have a weekly personal finance newsletter. Of course, there's the book where you can get it all major bookstores, independent bookstores. And hey, listen, if you can't afford the book, get it from the library. I'm okay about that too, right? I'm completely okay. Don't tell my publisher, but I'm completely okay with that, right? I'd rather you have the knowledge than worry about the fact that you can't buy the book.
Yes,
I love it. Michelle, this has been a joy talking with you today. We appreciate you just giving us some of your time. This has been a lot of fun. Thanks again.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Matt, what a great conversation with Michelle. Super awesome human being and just like super knowledgeable when it comes to personal finances. Also, I can't wait till they actually get that Mount Rushmore personal finance up, because she's definitely going to be on it and well deserved too.
Well, there's a difference too between being, you said iconic, right? You want to be iconic. You don't want to be like a legend, because when you're a legend, that means, you know, your best years are behind you. She's not a legend. She's iconic. She'll
be a legend 30 years from now.
She's at the top of her game right now though.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. So yeah, what was your big takeaway from that conversation?
Okay, well, so I've heard this before when it comes to loaning money to friends or family, to try not to actually lend them that money, and if possible, just give them that money. Hopefully, you are in a financial position where things are solid in your life, and by giving them that money, right, by gifting it, there's a much better chance of you maintaining that relationship, right? Without things getting weird, without the dynamic suddenly shifting, because all of a sudden, you know, they're thinking that you're about to ask them, like, hey, are you able to pay back yet?
So they're not coming over for dinner
and
anytime soon.
Even if you're not thinking that, that might be on their mind. But then you might be thinking things, right? Because you might see them spend some money, or you might hear them maybe going on a small trip or something, and you're thinking to yourself, wait a minute, like, you still owe me money. And so I've heard that before.
You can't afford to go to Tahiti?
Yeah. Oh, of course not. Yeah. And so I've heard that before. But one of the things she said that really stood out to me was to actively look for individuals to help who you're pretty sure might be hurting when it comes to their finances, right? I mean, we've got a lot of relationships in our lives. We know what folks are up to. We know, you know, we're familiar with the different industries that have suffered recently. And even aside from pandemics and massive crises like this, we need to still be aware of what it is that individuals are going through on a personal level. And so I just love that Michelle and her husband are actively searching for individuals they can help. They've made this a priority in their life as to, you know, what it is that they're doing with their money. And with someone like Michelle, who doesn't have a splurge, I mean, I would even venture to say that this is something that might even be considered a splurge.
Yeah, that's her splurge.
In her life.
An admirable splurge.
Yes, because I think a lot of folks would say, oh my gosh, I can't believe you do that. But for her, in reality, that's something that is able to bring her a lot of joy as well.
Yeah. All right. My big takeaway, I will say, from this conversation, a lot of good stuff. But when we talked about why she wrote the book, COVID was certainly a part of that, but you also never know when a crisis is going to hit. And one of the terms that she used in the book that she didn't actually bring up on this episode, but she said that you need to manage your personal finances like you're in the middle of a perpetual recession.
Right.
And I'm like, that's exactly how I approach my finances. It actually made me think of when we talked to Morgan Housel, and he basically said, invest like an optimist, but save like a pessimist. And I think that's the exact same approach, basically, living like you're in a perpetual recession or saving like you're pessimistic about the future. We should all be kind of taking that route with our finances, investing like optimist, saving like pessimist. Not sure what the future holds, but making sure that we're prepared for the event of a potential crisis. And you know what? They don't tell us ahead of time that they're coming. They usually kind of come out of nowhere. You know, COVID was definitely one of those things that came out of nowhere. The recession of 2008, you know, that was something that came out of nowhere. Most people weren't predicting that it was going to happen. I could point to so many different crises that have happened over the years that people were not predicting. And then there's just like the general things that happen to individuals, you know, in everyday life too. The crises of a family member getting sick or you getting sick, and they're just impossible to predict. And so you need to live life, manage your personal finances like you are in that perpetual recession. And if you do, you will be prepared when the next crisis hits.
Yeah. And I mean, and you're saying not to be stressed the whole time, right? Because because typically from an emotional standpoint, when you're in a crisis, you feel the squeeze a little bit, like things aren't going great and you want things to kind of go back to normal. But it's about taking the actions to make sure that you don't arrive to that point emotionally when there truly is a crisis. So yeah, man, I'm glad you pointed that out. And actually, dude, so I just said squeeze when you're sort of in a crisis. Let's go ahead and shift gears. Let's get it back to the beer that you and I enjoyed on this episode, which was called Squeeze Box. This is a beer by Urban Artifact, and this was a strawberry Midwestern fruit tart that was donated to the show by Sandra. Sandra, thank you so much for sending this one our way. Joel, what were your thoughts on this one?
Dude, this was awesome. This is a tart, funky strawberry beer. It had kind of like it was kind of thick, so it had some milkshake type mm-hmm. qualities to it. But I personally love a beer that brings the funk, and this one brought a lot of funk. It wasn't just straight up fruit, too sweet or anything like that. The funkiness plus the acidity plus the fruit, they balanced out really, really well, man. I really dug it.
Yeah, well, you mentioned milkshake. There's actually a good amount of vanilla bean in this beer as well, so that probably adds to the certain smoothness of it, right?
That's what I was feeling. Yeah. My palate is that brilliant.
You're so tuned in. So, dude, I wanted to point out one thing on the can here. They tell you the acidity of the beer. I have never seen a brewery that put the pH of the beer on here, and so this one is a 3.47, which is, so when it comes to acids and bases, like the lower the number, the higher it is in acidity, right? Yep. And so I'm kind of I'm a numbers nerd, and so for me to see that number on this can, like, it provides a frame of reference. And now any other beer I have that actually does happen to have the acidity level on there, I'm going to know where it stacks up against this one. I think that's really cool, man. I've never seen that before, and I think more breweries should be doing that.
There you go. Yeah, I'm down with more info. It's interesting info, something I never would have...
Let's get scientific about it.
...expected on my beer can, but that's really cool. And yeah, big thanks to Sandra for sending us this beer. But that's going to do it for today's episode. If you want to know where you can get Michelle's book, well, she mentioned the library, but you can also buy it if you want. We'll link to that one in our show notes up on our website at howtomoney.com.
That's right, man. So that's going to be it for this episode. Joel, until next time...
Best friends out.
Best friends out.